We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Good afternoon. Welcome to CETA's webinar on our new resource, State Procurement Case Studies, Spotlight on Digital Instructional Materials Acquisition. My name is Christine Fox, and I am CETA's Deputy Executive Director, and I am pleased to be presenting to you today with Becky Butler from the West Virginia Department of Education, as well as Molly Yell from the Indiana Department of Education. It was great to hear from many of you in the chat about your role related to instructional materials, and we hope you will continue to post comments and questions, and we will monitor the chat and engage the audience in the discussions. So joining right now on the webcam, you'll see Molly Yell, Digital Content Coordinator from Indiana Department of Education, and Becky Butler, Assistant Director for the Office of Middle and Secondary Learning, the West Virginia Department of Education. Both Molly and Becky are leaders in their state as related to instructional materials, and they are also active, longstanding CETA members. So we're happy to have them here today to share their stories about digital content. Just a short plug for the Essential Elements for Digital Content online community. We have over 1,200 members for this community, which is exciting, but we are really hoping for your engagement. So sharing things you learned today, highlighting resources from your school, district, or state would be wonderful for you to share more. There are a ton of resources, both CETA's as well as resources from other groups, and we hope that you're able to join and post. This is also where you can always review and revisit the recordings and slides from any of CETA's webinars. We would like to thank the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for supporting this work. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation supports CETA's instructional materials work specific to this webinar, this new resource, as well as multiple other suites of instructional materials resources for schools, districts, and states. So today, first, we will hear a little bit more about CETA and specifically about these case studies, and then we'll dive into the state perspective from both Molly and Becky, and then we'll offer the opportunity for question and answer. So again, be sure to post and share your questions and thoughts, and then we will make sure to address them either via the session and or the Q&A at the end. So I'll let Molly and Becky off the hook now on their cams, and I'll dive into the content, and we'll bring them back up in a few minutes. So a little bit about CETA. Those who are not familiar, we are a 16-year-old advocacy and professional learning association. Our members are state and educational, state and territory educational technology leaders. They may be from different departments, including leaders from digital learning offices, innovation, CIOs, instructional materials, professional learning offices as well. We provide the opportunity for interstate collaboration for development of resources such as this that serve the field and public and private partnerships so that we are engaging with the private sector and sharing more about how K-12 services work, as well as providing input on the development of new and upcoming resources related to K-12. CETA has multiple resources specific to digital content. We're going to dive into several of those just shortly in the next few slides. So we want to make sure that you visit our website and you can see links to multiple resources, including the DMAPS online portal, the Guide to Quality Instructional Materials. We have Navigating the Shift report from 2015, as well as the one highlighted here from 2017, and then some previous policy briefs. All of this work really stemmed from our out-of-print report in 2012. Last February, CETA published the Guide to Quality Instructional Materials, and this was really a resource that was requested by our members. In many cases, the digital learning leaders in states do not necessarily the folks that vet or provide guidance around instruction materials. But as content is switching to digital, those digital learning leaders are being looked to by states, by the schools and districts and states to be able to provide guidance around which digital content materials should be requested and or procured. From that, we created an online site, which you see the link here, and it's also in the chat, that is very comprehensive. It includes these six sections that are listed here. Most importantly, planning, and there are really specific details around the selection of quality instructional materials. That guide really does support the work that we're releasing today, because some of the case studies today include details about the selection process in addition to the procurement. In addition, in 2015, CETA published initially the DMAPS website, Digital Instructional Materials Acquisition Policies for States. It's an online interactive portal where you can view state policies related to instructional materials, including adoption policies, definitions for materials, accessibility policies as well. You can review an interactive map on the homepage that shows you which states have policies in which areas, and highlights national trends. In addition, you can do a deeper dive into each state. By clicking on a state, you can see details, including some narrative, as well as links to those state policies and practices. So we would encourage you to leverage both of these in support of these case studies. The case studies that we're releasing today actually also stemmed from requests from our membership. State leaders are interested in learning more about how states procure instructional materials, especially the difference between adoption and non-adoption states. So last winter, we did data collection and research to refresh the DMAPS website, which was launched as a refresh in June 2017. Then, based on the data sets from that work, we published the Navigating the Shift 2 paper, which was a follow-up to our 2015 Navigating the Shift paper. And that really highlighted national trends and focused on the learning opportunities related to digital instruction materials. You can access webinar archives from both of those launches here within the EdWeb community. And from that, we held working group discussions both in person and online to gather data from state leaders on what would be most important to include in these procurement case studies. We leveraged interaction with our state action committee. We interviewed instructional materials teams from states, and then we participated in the drafting and reporting process. Before we dive into the policies, I wanted to just highlight the fact that all CETA's focus really starts with the learning. Our goal is to focus in on why we are doing things that we do, why we are encouraging leadership at the state level and policies and practices that emphasize personalized learning opportunities. And we believe that digital learning opportunities help to provide deeper learning experiences. They're able to help personalize learning experiences for students. And so we want to always start with the goal in mind, and that is really increasing dynamic learning opportunities for students. So the greatest theme for this work is the fact that whether an adoption state or a non-adoption state, whether or not your state helps to leverage state master contracts or is completely left to local control, there are opportunities for states to provide leadership, and there is no one-size-fits-all approach. So we really don't have specific recommendations, as perhaps with other topics, that each state needs to look at their resources, their opportunities for leadership, and then to help provide guidance for their schools and districts as best possible. Again, just as with the vetting of content, the procurement takes planning. Each group needs to look at the access to materials and devices, consider budgets, the quality and alignment of those materials, especially full course, which is really the general focus of this work, as well as the types of materials available, and then to help ensure that the content is accessible to all learners, including those with disabilities. And then finally, if a school or district is going to provide digital instructional materials, those materials need to have, students need to have access to those materials both in school and outside of school, which at times, and this does have the schools consider access to devices as well as access to broadband outside of school buildings and outside of school hours. Within procurement practices, there are multiple considerations. So there are many states submit or release requests for proposals or requests for information, RFI. Some states do that on independent level via the State Department of Education. Sometimes they have to work with their procurement office, which sits outside of the Department of Education, but within state government. At times, states have leveraged multi-state RFPs. There is one specific to devices through the Maine Learning Technology Initiative. In other states, most of the RFPs are released through regional consortia, so a group of districts or a conglomerate of districts from across the state release RFPs to help support the procurement more broadly than one individual district. And then there are also opportunities for partnerships with the public and private sector, so that perhaps at times these are partnerships where content or resources are available at little or no cost, and other times they are through a grant application or process. Many states do provide guidance. The states listed here provide guidance specific to digital instructional materials: California, Louisiana, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, New York, Virginia, and West Virginia. In addition, this information is available to via DMAPS. 27 states provide guidelines for publishers interested in selling instructional materials. So those of you from the private sector, if you visit DMAPS, you can see the list of those 27 states, and you can dig into the policies and practices related to those states. If you're not from the private sector, you still should be aware whether or not your state provides these guidelines, because if you're working with vendors within your market, you want to make sure that they are abiding by the guidelines provided by the state. As you can imagine, this process is not simple. Regardless of how long states have been providing leadership and they have been working with their schools and districts, there are always challenges and considerations related to the procurement. So I would just like to share that some things to consider are sustainability. When you have partnerships or regional consortia groups, you have to think about long-term sustainability. When you have specific grant funding or a line item within your state budget and your districts are depending on that, that can be a challenge or consideration depending on how the funding flows. In addition, there are considerations around effectiveness. So you are sure to review content and make sure that it's vetted so that it looks to be and meets the criteria for high quality and it's aligned to standards. But then you also want to look at its effectiveness and how well that content is being applied and implemented in the classroom. And then there are multiple policies that may be need to change over time depending on how your schools and districts are adhering to that, how they're shifting to digital, how digital content may be outside of the realm of simple things like seat time and or access to other courses that might not fall within your classic criteria within your particular district. Another big consideration is the players in the space. So as you're looking at reviewing content and you're looking at decision makers, engaging the community and all of the stakeholders, including the parents and even students, to help support these decisions can also help with buy-in. So the four states that we took a deeper dive into for the procurement case studies are California, Louisiana, Utah, and Indiana. And I'm pleased to share that Utah has presented on a previous CETA EdWeb webinar related to how they support and provide leadership around the adoption policy. California and Louisiana presented just in August, so you can learn more about them by reviewing that archive. Indiana is a specific case study today, and we have West Virginia sharing because even though there are these four states that we really took a deep dive into their procurement processes, we also highlighted multiple states that have examples of different things they're doing to really showcase different opportunities and attempts to provide leadership at the state level. So we're excited to have West Virginia here today too. We chose these states for multiple reasons. We wanted to make sure that they were truly leaders in the implementation of digital learning. We wanted to provide access to resources that gave roadmaps for other states and the districts within their states to leverage. So the states that we've chosen have really shown leadership within their state. They publish and share as much content as they can around their adoption policies, their procurement, their statewide contracts. And so any state can truly learn from the information that they're providing. And again, we also highlight little snippets from additional states because there are so many great things going on around the country. As you can see on this chart, we try to track some of the things that the states have in common. Clearly here, the difference between an adoption state and a non-adoption state, there are more things happening and more policies within an adoption state. As we've noted here, California, Louisiana, and Utah. Indiana, although a non-adoption state, does provide guidance and has a definition for textbooks. And they also are going to talk to you about the fact that they are able to support the vetting and providing leadership at the state level, even though all of the decisions are made at the local level. Finally, looking at this chart, you'll notice even though California, Louisiana, and Utah are adoption states, they still have local control. So at the end of the day, in most cases, for almost all of the adoption states, districts still have the option to choose the content that they would like to implement, and there are ways that they can appeal to the state or receive an exemption to leverage other resources not on an adoption list that hadn't been previously approved. Having said that, in most of these states, the schools and districts typically leverage the resources that the state has adopted because small schools, small districts, rural areas do not have the capacity to review multiple resources, to negotiate contracts and master contracts. And so they leverage the leadership that the state has provided so that they can then use those resources and use their own internal resources more specifically for professional learning and other areas. So typically, although they have the option, most districts do choose the content that the states has reviewed. So I'm happy to let you hear more details from our leader from Indiana, and we're happy to have Molly Yell here. As I mentioned, she is an active CETA member. She has had 11 years of experience in public schools, and in addition to that, 5 years working with the Indiana Department of Education. She's our digital content coordinator for the Office of eLearning, and she's also leads the state's Go Open initiative. So Indiana has a unique approach, but we're happy to share how much they show and provide leadership at the state level, regardless of the fact that they are a non-adoption local control state. So I'm going to turn it over to Molly and let you learn more.
All right. Thank you, Christine. I assume y'all can hear me okay, and I'll
yes.
get started. Okay, so like Christine said, we looked a little different on the chart compared to some of the other states that they studied. I think that probably changed for us around 2011 when Indiana districts were basically given the freedom to choose the digital or the instructional materials that worked best for their students. We changed our textbook adoption policy to include not only chosen textbooks, but any sort of software or online services or even devices that would support student learning. With that, the Indiana textbook definition did change, and I included that there for you. And you'll notice that that also includes books, hardware, and computer software and digital content. Since then, we have seen a lot of districts over the past six or so years to take some of that traditional funding that came from textbook monies and have shifted those funds to pay for devices and then other services, professional development for teachers around the area of digital content curation. And so we have a lot of unique practices going on across the state in our districts because we were given this freedom in 2011 to kind of forego traditional textbook adoptions and really use instructional materials that met the needs of our students. So I love that. I think it's given us a lot of freedom across the state. It is, you know, definitely added more work to our plates, but I think it's best for our students. And it's great as a teacher, because I teach one class still, to have that freedom and that choice in my class so I can really cater to my students each semester, each school year. So we are free, as it says, to procure our own instructional materials as teachers and districts. That's kind of left, like Christine said, to the local level, to school boards and superintendents and teachers, of course. The Office of E-Learning of the Indiana Department of Education, of which I work with, we do offer support down this path as our districts transition from more traditional resources to digital content. Most districts seem to be living kind of in a blended environment at this time, using some old and then some new. Some paid online services and instructional materials, some free and some open. And so we're kind of all over the place on this continuum. And so we try to offer support at different levels through the Department of Ed to support all teachers, no matter where they're at on that continuum. So, and as Christine mentioned, we are a Go Open state. And so we are slowly signing on districts to dedicate to making that transition and starting to procure more resources, open resources, and share those out as well. So because we are a local control state around this idea of instructional materials, at the Office of E-Learning through the Department of Ed, we have a lot of different programs that support teachers around procurement. So I will talk about a few of them. These are kind of all the programs that we have going on in our small but mighty team of 6.5 to serve the state. So the cohort that I lead is called the I and E-Learn Rockstars of Curation. And this is a cohort that we started about 4 years ago when we noticed that a lot of teachers were making this shift. They were interested in making the transition. Most districts were not providing them updated materials because they weren't going through their regular 6 or 7 year textbook adoption cycle. Their students were getting devices, but you know, teachers realized that it takes a lot of time to do this work and to make that transition. And we felt like they needed some help to get them started and some quality examples. And as we've all kind of made our way down this path, we just like to contribute quality resources in any way that we can to support teachers. So basically, we have gathered some expert teachers in a variety of fields, K-12. Our focus has been on ELA, social studies, math, and science. And we have about 8 media specialists as well, because that's what they do. We always call them the original curators. And so they're great. They're a great resource if your state is not utilizing your media specialists in the districts, then I suggest that you start, because this is what they do. This is what they're trained on. And most of them love to do it. So What we've done with the Rockstars of Curation is we just devote, we invest in those teachers to share their expertise. Most of them are already living in a digital world and are already procuring and sharing out. And so we just give them a platform to do that. We'll bring them in and help pay for their subs and their travel. We'll provide professional learning on a variety of topics to kind of keep them sharp and to support their growth. And then everything that they curate and all the resources that they vet for us across the state, they use in their own classrooms. They share with their colleagues, not only in their district, but across the state. And we're doing that now through Amazon Inspire. So that's one way that we support our teachers in the area of procurement is through the Rockstars. And then we also have leveled grants. You'll see the digital learning grant there. That is the second of four grants that we offer each year or every other year to our districts. And this is typically for districts that are already have a one-to-one initiative or program in place that are looking to expand it or that want to really invest in their teachers in the area of procurement. And they are able to offer professional development to their teachers. They're able to pay for subs to take them out of the classroom throughout the summer to do some of this work. And so that's another way that we support our teachers is through our kind of tiered grant program that we have. We also have what's called the digital content curation workshops. And I will go across the state usually four or five times a year and try to reach all corners and areas. I've been doing this for 3 or 4 years. And so we try to hit where, you know, any teacher can find a workshop within an hour or so of their district at some point in time. And we talk about the basics of, you know, digital content curation, what the process looks like, and we offer support and professional learning around that. It's a free workshop that we offer to teachers. We even pay for their subs, so their districts are happy to send them because we help cover the cost for that. So that's another way that we support in this area. We also have the e-learning lab. So we'll have webinars throughout the school year on digital content and accessibility. That was one of our more recent ones. We just had one last month talking about Amazon Inspire and Go Open. And so we'll offer webinars throughout the school year and then archive those as a resource for our teachers. We also host the Summer of E-Learning, where we partner with school districts, and they will be a host site throughout the summer and bring in national speakers and then also have their local expert teachers share and do different sessions. And we'll oftentimes have a lot of sessions around this idea of procurement and people sharing up that way. I think this past summer we had 20. Summer of e-learning conferences across the state, and the year before we had 24. We'll usually reach 8,000 to 12,000 teachers because of that program. And then one of the other ones, these are all kind of partnerships that we have with districts through a variety of programs and grant funding that we offer. But we also do have a few paid partnerships. One we have is with NBC Learn, and so all of our Indiana teachers have access to NBC Learn and all of their content for free because of the partnership that we have with them. And of course, it's something that teachers are free to take and use. You know, it's not state mandated. They don't have to. We just offer that resource because we see value in it. I don't know. Let me make sure I got everything that I want to talk about. Yeah, I think so. So like Christine, again, I'll mention we are a local control state. We do support our teachers through different programs that we offer out of the Office of E-Learning and then a few paid partnerships that we have to offer digital content to teachers for free. But we really like kind of the grassroots approach. We like to bring teachers in. We like to support them professionally in this area, and we like to give them time and resources so that they can curate content that they can use in their classrooms, but then share out across the state and the country and the world for anyone to take and use. So we like to provide quality examples and then give them support down this path.
Great. Thank you, Molly. I have a follow-up question, and then there is a question in the chat that I'm going to ask, and then would ask you to come back on at the end. There'll probably be more questions. So one is, most of the leadership that you've talked about at the state level is to support teachers and their curation process and the districts as well. And so it sounds like a lot of this is for supplemental materials, but I wonder if you've seen some of this transferred to full course or how you could comment on that.
Yeah, I think that we have districts all over the place. Like any other state, probably you have some early adopters, you have some teachers that are more comfortable making this transition to a more digital environment, and some that are, you know, kind of living in that blended world, and some that are holding tight to their traditional ways. And part of these programs, like the workshops, is showing them the value in making this transition, and even if it is to supplement at first. And then the value and the collaboration and the sharing that comes with especially the Go Open initiative. I think for most teachers, it does start off as a supplemental approach, but we are slowly seeing more and more teachers really embrace this and make the full transition. And they are strictly, you know, digital instructional materials for the courses. And most of them are a mix between a paid service, like maybe their district pays for BrainPop for them. So they might use BrainPop, but then they also use free and open resources as well. I say that because we have what we call the e-learning day program. And so we actually have districts across the state that apply to participate in this program, and they can take e-learning days throughout the school year, or they can use them, you know, for snow days during bad weather, where that morning a district could, you know, reach their stakeholders and say, today's going to be an e-learning day, and the teachers are ready to go, and everything is done online, and the teachers and students communicate that way, and all, you know, instructional materials are digital. So I know we have some people living in the full digital world, but I think it's definitely a blend.
Thank you. And then just quickly before we transition to Becky, there was a question in the chat about funding. So does the Indiana Department of Ed provide direct funding for instructional materials as a specific line item, or how does that work for your districts?
So our office has our Office of E-Learning, which is a part of the Department of Ed. We obviously have a budget, and within that budget, we then budget certain monies to support these programs. So let's take the Rockstars of Curation, for instance. A lot of people ask, how do we afford? We have about 50 teachers, and we pay for their travel and their subs, any professional learning. We'll even pay to send them to, you know, state conferences so they can grow themselves. And it doesn't cost us really as much as you would think. I think my budget's like $25,000 to support that group. So not a ton of money, but a lot of work gets done, and the teachers feel valued. We do not pay directly for like digital content to be like to individual districts. We support the teachers through these grants and such. But, you know, our rule with like the digital learning grants is if you earn a grant from our office and part of that is for digital content curation and you're going to provide PD for your teachers and give them subs, anything that they curate and create, of course, then they then in turn have to share across the state with everyone else. So that's how we work it out.
And then does each, so not out of your e-learning office, but out of the department's budget per district, is there a line item for instructional materials in general for every district in
not
the state,
district.
Or is that something not
no,
per district?
Not.
Okay. Okay. All right. Great. All right. Well, thank you so much. So we look forward to you engaging in the Q&A at the end. And I'm just going to, as Becky Butler from West Virginia is pulling up her camera, I'm just going to ask folks in the chat to share a little bit about yourself. Has your state, your school, your district changed policies to support digital learning opportunities? You know, have you provided more flexibility? Molly just shared a little bit about e-learning days related to snow days. But we'd love to hear more about what you all are doing within your state. And in the meantime, while you're sharing some flexibility that's been provided, I will introduce Becky Butler. She's from the West Virginia Department of Education. Becky is kind of holds two hats. She's a CETA member and she's been part of their digital learning team, but she's also a member of CIMRA, the State Instructional Materials Review Association. And CIMRA is a CETA affiliate. And I noticed there are quite a few CIMRA members on the call today. So we're excited to have their support and participation within CETA and to be able to engage with the digital learning leaders in a state are connecting now with the instructional materials leaders. And that's really important as we transition to this shift to digital. Becky is the assistant director of the Office of Middle and Secondary Learning, and she's also the director of the West Virginia Virtual School, and she supervises the West Virginia Instructional Materials Adoption Process. So as many state Department of Education leaders, she wears multiple hats, and she is a former math and music teacher, and we're excited to hear more about West Virginia, which is an adoption state, so they have a bit more formal process. And I'm going to turn it over to Becky.
Thank you, Christine. Okay, so as Christine said, we are an adoption state. So everything about our adoption process for instructional materials is laid out in state code or in state policy. So our adoption for instructional materials is on a 6-year cycle. And so that's spelled out in the one policy listed there. We also have instructions for publishers on our website. And the adoption schedule, just real quick, we go through 6 cycles. So right now we're currently in the middle of our mathematics instructional materials adoption, and next year is going to be social studies and pre-K. So it is really a 2-year cycle. It's constantly ongoing, but you can see how things spell out and where things fall. If it is not considered in one of these lists, then it's states, counties. Counties have full flexibility to select what they want. Primary instructional materials must contain digital content. So that's where, in order to be considered primary, there has to be an online, interactive, or some sort of a digital content there for the students and for the teachers to use. And it needs to be more than just a platform. There is a formal process that they must go through in order to be placed on the state official multiple list. And then after that, and we want to get as many resources as possible to go on that list because we want to give the districts as much flexibility in their selection as we possibly can. Some of our counties are 1-to-1. Our districts are our counties. So some of those are 1-to-1, and so they're going to want a resource that's totally digital. Other districts are not able to go 1-to-1 yet, so they have money to buy the instructional materials, but not necessarily enough technology to give every student a device of some sort. So they need to have that flexibility where they have the print materials, but they will also want an online component that they can use in their classroom or that students could possibly use at home. They want to make sure that every student has access to a device of some sort to use as electronic resources. Supplemental materials are totally up to the district. The district reviews them. The district makes the selection. We are there if they ask us questions, if they need help in how do you review these? How do you go through and decide what's going to be usable or not? But for the most part, the state facilitates the primary instructional materials portion, and we leave the supplemental totally to the districts, and they can go out and work with any provider that they wish to do. So here is how our adoption process works. We start in late October, early November, and we actually set criteria, and this is how the review is going to be, how we are going to judge the materials to what we're looking for. So that we bring in a team of teachers from throughout the state. They sit down. The State Department does not say this is what you have to do. The State Department says, what do you think is important that the instructional materials have in there so that you can teach and so that the students can learn? So they set that criteria in November. Then in January, that's my job. I get to put out the call to bid. And I usually release it towards the end of January. And it closes usually the beginning of April. So that gives the publishers lots of time to go through. When I put out the call to bid, the criteria is also put up on the website, so that they can look at the criteria themselves. They can take a look and decide whether or not their materials will meet what we're looking for, and then they can place a bid. One of the really good things about the bid is that we have large districts, we have small districts, just like every other state. But the publishers have to agree that no matter how many of those materials a district decides to buy, whether it's one or whether it's 10,000, the price has to be the same across the board. So we have a contract that goes out, and they have to sign that and agree that every county gets equal opportunity. And just because you're big, you don't get a better price than one of our smaller districts. Once the call to bid has been placed and the bids close, we make arrangements to meet with two committees. The first one is called the IMAC, and this one is, IMAC is detailed also in state code. It is the Instructional Materials Advisory Committee, and this is a team of educators. Some are teachers. We have a few administrators on there. Sometimes we will have a retired teacher who joins us, and these members stay on that committee for a minimum of 3 years. And they are responsible for running the review. So again, I am there. We have State Department people there. Our content people are there to answer questions if there's a question about a standard, but we don't sit there and go through the books. We leave that to the teachers. So the IMAC team is the one who will run those review sessions. And then we have the IMRC, which is the Instructional Materials Review Committee. And these are teachers who are content specialists. They are from the classroom. They know what they need, and they know what equipment is out there in the classrooms for them to use. So we do a training in May. The review teams, both committees, will get the materials in June, and then they get back and they do the reviews independently. Then they all come back together in July, and they will deliberate on their findings. So you may have one teacher for one part of the state that says, oh, this is very in-depth. And then you'll have another teacher who says, this is minimal. So you have the committee who gets into some very good conversation. And you see them pulling up the books and logging onto the websites. And so, well, I found stuff here, here, and here. And the other people will be saying, oh, well, yeah, that's really great. And then they will deliberate. And they must come to a consensus before a rating is established. So those committees will be doing that. We take these findings to the state board in November. So between the time they deliberate and the time that the board sees these recommendations, there are times for the publishers to appeal if they don't like the findings, if we said something did not meet the standards. They have that opportunity to go in and appeal, and we go through a long process for that. And then once the multiple list is released by our state board, then the counties get to start their selection process. And that happens from mid-November till sometime by the 1st of May. They're supposed to have it all finished. So that's pretty much how that goes. Alan, I'm not catching all of them, but you say if a district buys a $5 book for 100 copies, it's $500. If that is how they put that in the bid, yes. There is no discount for multiple copies. So there is an option of single copies, classroom copies, or countywide copies. So they do have a slight option there in the initial bid, but that same pricing has to be good in every district. So there is a slight difference there. The evaluation criteria when we divide, that we break this down on, is we have generic criteria. These are non-negotiable. They have to meet 100% of this. And so it must have digital formatting. It must be bias-free. This is a yes-no simple. Yes, it has digital content. No, it does not have digital content. If all four of those are not met, then the material is automatically set aside. Now, they still go through the review in case they can show us, yes, we did have equal opportunity or we were bias-free, and so we complete the review. But if they cannot show us during an appeals that all four of those are met or all five, sometimes, for example, in science, we also had another one on lab safety, because they thought that was mandatory that every science material have that in there. So that must be 100%. We have general criteria, and that usually relates to instructional teacher resources. This, with the general criteria, the materials only need to meet 80% of all the criteria that's listed there. And that rubric is listed as an in-depth, an adequate, minimal, or non-existent. And the in-depth and adequate actually get the same score, same on the rubric, and a minimal or non-existent also get the same score. So it's like a 1 and 0. You also have specific criteria. And specific criteria is aligned to the current state standards of specific content and grade level. So this is where we'll go through, we'll pull the college and career readiness standards for mathematics. And so each grade level is broken down, everything's reviewed against that, and it must also meet 80% of the specific criteria. And we use the same rubric for the specific as the general. And if you need examples, I put a link in there so you can take a look at our criteria examples and our correlation documents. The publishers are asked to create a correlation document for everything that they bid. And so they tell us, here is where in our book, or here is where it is on our online materials, or in the teacher's edition, that each of these items, each of these criteria are found. So they give us as much information as they possibly can. And to be quite honest, the publishers who give us more usually do better. The publishers who leave a lot of blanks, and if the teacher and teacher reviewers can't find the, and the publishers didn't mention it, then we have to assume that it wasn't in there. So the more they give us, the better it helps on the review. Okay. Contracts are good for 6 years. Okay. Off-cycle adoptions are good until the end of an adoption period. So on-cycle is mathematics right now, but we will continue to review other mathematics materials for the next 4 more years after the on-cycle year. We always take 1 year in between before we start over again. Prices in the bid cannot be increased during the contract period. Okay? They can be reduced. You can drop it down, which goes to what I'm calling the most favored nation pricing clause. I believe Utah has this as well. So if the price drops someplace, they have to automatically give it to the state of West Virginia. So if the price drops, if the price drops, then we have to get it. If okay, I've lost that thought, so I'm going to go on. Materials are guaranteed to be available throughout the duration of the contract. So if they want to change a version, they have to go through a little mini. They have to submit those. We have to look them over and make sure that the contents, if the content is still there and reliable and still meets all of the standards and the criteria. However, if there are updates, especially to the online content, you know, that happens. If they're just minor updates, so they can go through and make those without a review. We just ask that they let us know. But if there are major updates, we do have to take a look at those materials again. Updates to the platform are allowed, but there can be no additional cost to the district. So that is how the contract works. Alan, you were asking if we have found publishers are reliable in the correlation documents. Some are very reliable and others are not. One thing that I have found that our reviewers are good at is we've had publishers in the past who will tell us that something's not in the document, I mean, in their materials, but when we go back through and actually are doing the review, our reviewers will see it and they'll just say, oh, in West Virginia, we call that whatever the term is, but the publisher called it something else. So we will go through and a lot of times help the publishers because they are very careful about the review. But yes, sometimes publishers will tell us things are there, or sometimes if we give them a Word document instead of just a straight PDF, we've had people eliminate criteria because it wasn't in there, and so we have to be extra careful. So, okay, and once a publisher's materials have been approved and they are on the multiple list, then the publishers are responsible for getting a Lexile score for anything that's approved as primary instructional materials. The supplemental do not need to do this. They also have to get the quantile scores for anything that's math and science. Any core and correlated print materials must be submitted to NIMAC in NIMAS format so that it will help with the accessibility. And then they're available for any of our students or teachers who need that accommodation. We also require that some professional development on the use of the materials to the teachers in the districts be available at no additional cost. Now, some publishers will go over and above the basic professional development, but we need to make sure that the teachers in the districts that these materials are purchased for, that they have an understanding, a good, strong understanding of what's available and how to use them. Because it's no longer, as in the days when I started teaching, it's no longer just a textbook and a teacher's edition. So they are just required to provide. They need that professional development to help them understand all the different ancillaries and all the different materials and how to find things on the online website. Ongoing support for requirements for materials. They are required to provide basic support on how to use the materials. That was a question that someone had here. So, but they are not required to go really in-depth professional development. So I might need a little bit more information on that. The last thing that we have put in place and we have found very, very helpful is that all materials purchased need to be in the district two weeks before the start of school. We have had some instances where the publishers did not have the materials in place, but the schools that are the districts had already got rid of their old materials. And so teachers were out there sort of struggling and looking for things. And if you're a an experienced teacher and you've been teaching for a long time, you have other materials that you can start the classroom with. But if you're a brand new teacher or have only been teaching 1 year, then you're not going to have that supply of things that you've used in the past. And if you come in and you have 2 days before school starts to start coming up with all these materials, it's very difficult. OERs. If a county is allowed, a district is allowed to use open education resource materials, we ask them to pull their materials together. You know, as you know, there's so many that are out there, and they will submit it at the same time the publishers do, and we have the same review committee that will go through and vet the materials. And if we see that there's something that's missing, we will tell them, and they can go back and scaffold in some additional materials as are needed.
Well, thank you, Becky. We lost the audio at the very end there, but it was your, oh, there you are. So, and I'd love for Molly to come back on. We just have a couple of minutes. I know there's some questions that have been posted in the chat and some that are just to the presenters. So a couple things I wanted to address. There were some questions about accessibility. I know Molly posted a comment about their patents project in Indiana, and then Becky actually addressed the fact that there are requirements in West Virginia related to the accessibility of those materials. I would like to share that CETA does have a partnership with the AIMS Center, and we are working with our state leaders, our digital learning leaders, as well as CETA supports Go Open. And actually on Friday, the Go Open states are going to have a presentation by the AIMS Center on considering OER and accessibility. So that is an issue there. And I think noted by Alan, so I'll just say that overall our reflections in the paper, we didn't have official recommendations because there are so many variables related to this. We do have a conclusion at the end that's called reflections, and it highlights examples from the states you hear from here, the case studies, as well as other states on things folks are doing to provide that leadership. Truly, I think the difference between the official adoption states and those non-adoption is the adoption states have a probably more robust review process. They also help with that negotiating and the price negotiating. And sound, West Virginia is pretty comprehensive in their requirements. So I think companies really have to think about when they apply and their commitment over 6 years and as they update and share and even the idea that I can't remember the term at the moment, where if price is reduced, then West Virginia gets that reduced price. So it sounds like also, Becky, your office has learned over time. For example, that last example you gave about you have to have the product in the schools 2 weeks in advance, I can imagine is lessons learned. So the beauty of all of this and the fact that we're leveraging digital is that you can access this paper, which has links to all the information that's been shared today, as well as the slide deck. We're happy that both Molly and Becky took the time. It takes time to prepare these and do a tech check and then be on, and it takes time out of their really busy schedule. So hopefully you have learned from them. There are quite a few states instructional materials leaders on today, and we have highlighted some of their work, whether via other CETA webinars, this paper at CETA Leadership. Hope to continue to spread the wealth and share that information over time. And so to wrap up, a great way to engage in this conversation and post your questions. And I know Molly, and we've asked Becky to be on, they can respond in the digital content community on EdWeb. So we would encourage you to do that. We have posted here Twitter handles and emails, and I know the chat has been really good about that as well. So you can always email us, and we are happy to support your work. Again, thank you to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for their funding to help make this happen. So I guess it's good when we're running out of time, especially for a topic like procurement, which is not always, you know, the most exciting thing or the warm, fuzzy type of content. But all of these things are important. And I'm guessing that even Indiana and West Virginia learned something about each other today. And they might be able to leverage their own resources and models across the state. So cheers to state leadership. We look forward to our next event. And please continue the conversation online. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.